This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today, we are starting the sixth installment of the Harry Potter series, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, beginning with chapters 1 and 2, The Other Minister and Spinner's End. In these chapters, Harry is nowhere to be found.
This is a lot of adult stuff happening in these two chapters.
Yeah, a lot of adult stuff, and this is our first departure from Harry since the Riddle House in Goblet of Fire.
Okay, yeah. And then I think chapter 2 did that pick up with the Dursleys pretty quick after that. But
yeah, like immediately it picked up. So it was just one chapter. And then This time it's two chapters that have nothing to do with Harry.
We got some heavy hitters in the second
Which chapter. Begs the question of how did Harry the writer get hold of this information? Who did he talk to? Whose memories did he see?
Rita Skeeter. She was the bug in Snape's house.
Or in the minister's. But yeah. So first let's talk about, you know, how do you feel about that we are on book 6?
So this is the furthest I've made it in my Harry Potter journey, because I think that, you know, I have some, like, I have now read the first 5 books. There is some speculation if I've read the other ones at some point in my life. I don't know. Definitely have not read this one. So this is all new to me. I know there were some big things that happen, and one that I know I'm going to be very upset about. But and I like how it starts already. I mean, it starts, I don't know. We can talk about it in chapter 2, but I really like chapter 2.
Okay, but first chapter 1, The Other Minister. So this chapter is all about the interaction at the head of state level between the Muggle Prime Minister and the Minister of Magic, which quite frankly is very one-sided. It's not the type of diplomatic relationship that you would expect. And I guess I'm not that I was totally unaware of it, but I guess I honed in more this time about how infantilizing wizards are towards Muggles, the actual head of freaking state.
Yeah, it made me think of, you know, some of the presidents when they know some things, like some secrets. And obviously, I mean, that was...
Yeah, like that the aliens are real. Yeah, and all that. Yeah.
Hell yeah. Yeah, Bigfoot and all that. But you're exactly right. I mean, you know, they definitely treat this minister like he is an idiot, but also kind of fairly, maybe, because there is a lot of power that the wizards have that the Muggles just don't.
Yeah, but, you know, Muggles also have nuclear power.
That's true.
Like, you know, maybe in direct, like, hand-to-hand between two individuals, it's not much of a fight. But if it were going to be some larger societal, like, blowout war, like, again, the Muggles have plenty of instruments at their weapons of mass destruction that they could use. So
you are not wrong.
Yeah, so I'm just thinking maybe at one point it was okay to infantilize them, but after Hiroshima, then...
Yeah, and infantilizing somebody is never really, like, the cool thing. So, yeah. I don't know. This was very stately. This very much felt like a continuation of the last book. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because obviously number five, book five, was the introduction of all the political intrigues, and that even though it's not the main bad guy, that the Ministry of Magic, namely Fudge and Umbridge, were not being very helpful.
Right.
So now we've got the Prime Minister who has, as we find out, the way he's connected to the Muggle world, because there's this portrait of this little man that's actually a wizarding portrait that can talk and move and all these things.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Yeah, I think you were going down the same road I was.
Yeah, no, but before he, Prime Minister is lamenting, you know, there's been a hurricane, there's been this crazy mist, a bridge has collapsed, just lots of disasters going on, and he's having to deal with it. People criticizing, oh, the infrastructure wasn't solid, like, you're not spending enough money on this and that. And he's like, what the hell? So he's lamenting all of these woes that he's having to deal with. And then the little portrait is like announcing to the Prime Minister of Muggles, urgent, we meet, kindly respond immediately, sincerely, Fudge. And as we learn, this is not the first time he's interacted with Fudge.
Right.
So what do you think of his sort of trip down memory lane where he like describes his previous interactions with Fudge?
It's interesting to kind of learn how the things that we know about and we saw very clearly in the Wizarding World affect, you know, the Muggle world. And then also, the reporting, I think as soon as he said something to the effect of like, this will be like a one-time thing, don't worry about it. And then he's like in his office, like every couple years, which of course, this guy's going to freak out. Also, some blatant disregard for the, I'm assuming, American president at the very beginning. They're like, no, that's not important. Which kind of begs the question, like, I guess some of these issues, you know, Sirius Black was an issue. I don't know. It's just interesting to think that this is kind of puts those dynamics into a different perspective than it has the other books, because this is so much focused on how one affects the other.
Mm-hmm. So Cornelius Fudge is much more disheveled than he usually is, even though he's still got that stupid lime bowler hat.
Gross.
Yeah. At least have a nice, like, emerald green. Like, not lime.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not very good. Probably not very flattering either, I would imagine.
Yep, so Fudge goes on to explain that all the bad things that have been happening that the Prime Minister is dealing with are in fact magically, you know, created. It was not a hurricane, it was giants.
Right, yeah. How many, like, people in power would love to have, you know, magic to blame some of this stuff on? And maybe it is, and we just don't know. It's the aliens screwing everything up. We don't know.
Yep. Giants are hurricanes. The collapse of the bridge was induced by wizards. The mist that's everywhere and everything being all gloomy, that, it, you know, is the Dementors breeding.
I like, when I read that, I was like, what? How can these things, maybe I don't want to know.
I don't think you want to know.
Breed? Like, what the hell is going on here? That made me pause.
Yep. And so Prime Minister is really frustrated because it's like, it's even worse now because he knows exactly what's happening, but he's not in a position that he can tell the public or really tell anyone. Yeah. And they very much show it as if, like, the Prime Minister is literally the only person they tell. But I'm thinking, like, realistically, shouldn't, like, the heads of, like, MI5 and Secret Service, like, I would assume there would be multiple people at the head that would have to be in on this at least a little bit.
Yeah, you'd kind of think so. I don't know, man. I don't know how all this works, but you would think.
Mm-hmm. And so all in all, Fudge has come first when the Prime Minister came into office just to explain everything. And yeah. then he came once when Sirius Black escaped. And yeah. then he came the next year when they were importing when he talked about the chaos of the Quidditch World Cup and that they were importing three dragons for the Triwizard Tournament.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and, don't mind us.
Yeah. And is like, nothing to worry about, but the Department of Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures says the rules are, I have to inform you.
So I didn't really want.
But. Yep, and then after that, it's Fudge came to tell him about the mass breakout in Azkaban with Bellatrix, Dolohov, and all those other mofos escaped.
Yeah, oof.
And it's just, and so basically, it has not fostered a good relationship where Fudge only shows up with bad news.
Yeah, yeah, maybe tell him, you know, oh, by the way, we got rid of monkeypox or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, or like, you know, we cured cancer or something. Right. And, you know, like, let's do one good thing to balance out, like, it's all just gloom and doom every time I show up in the flyer.
Right. Throw us muggles a bone.
Yeah, so then, so we get kind of all of this history. Well, and also it's when Fudge is telling him now that like Voldemort is back and it's like open warfare now, like the Prime Minister isn't totally out of context because he's kind of been told about Voldemort in the few years ago in the context of when Sirius Black escaped.
Yeah, and definitely he who must not be named, you know, and all of that, they were still using that language. Mm-hmm. Even I mean, I guess the wizards are freaked out by him. So.
And also, it also, this is a really sticking point with me about Fudge and his, like, you know, betrayal of Dumbledore and trying to undermine Dumbledore. Like, even when he was explaining to the Prime Minister about Sirius Black, you know, thinking that, you know, you think he wants to join, you know, who again? So again, like, there was a pretty consensus amongst Wizarding Society and, like, high-ranking officials like Fudge, that it wasn't out of the total realm of possibility because there never was a body that Voldemort could be chilling out somewhere.
Right, right.
You know, and so when the fact that that Fudge just blatantly is denying as if there was a body that they had, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's Fudge, like, really
yeah.
screwed up.
But again, as we were just discussing off-mic, the level of cognitive distance, that cognitive dissonance that people will engage in to justify their hypocritical behavior, even when that includes pro-life women going to an abortion clinic in a different city than where they live because they were protesting outside their town's clinic.
And then, like, telling the doctor they're going to go to hell. Like, that's, I will admit I'm wrong, like, anytime. I have no problem admitting I'm wrong. But, so there's, like, one thing if you were like, you know what, I shouldn't have been doing that. But instead, you're like, by the way, you're still going to hell. That's, I don't get it. I don't get it.
So, yeah. Again, not just that's the hot topic now with the overturn of Roe versus Wade, but we've plenty of cognitive dissonance all around with the COVID stuff. So cognitive dissonance, like, again, humans don't behave logically. They never have, they never will. And this is kind of, and in fact, and pointing out, you know, the lack of logic only makes them dig their heels in farther.
Yeah, that's true.
Because we're social creatures and we'd rather stay with the tribe than, you know. So, anyway, so that always gets me because there's all this evidence that suggests that Fudge was never one of those people, like, pushing that, oh, you know, Voldemort is dead before Goblet of Fire. And then when shit actually hits the fan, it's like, no, he's dead. That's impossible. Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. God, this guy.
Mm-hmm. And so, one of the junior ministers has been quacking, like, going around quacking like a duck.
Yeah, that's a little, I don't know. I'm
like, and and they believe him to be the victim of a poorly cast Imperius curse, and they've transferred him to St. Mungo's Hospital of Magical Maladies and Injuries, and since then he's tried to strangle three healers.
This guy needs to chill. Yeah. So something's going on there.
And then very sad news. We find out Amelia Bones has been killed.
Yeah.
Do you remember who she was?
She's the one who gave Harry a fair shake, basically, yeah. in that trial.
Yeah, she,
right?
yeah, she was the one who in most circumstances, Harry would have only been dealing with her in her office, you know, handling this matter. And then Fudge rigged it where it had to be the whole, like, freaking court.
Fudge. What a fudge of a person.
Yeah. And then not only is Amelia Bones now dead, but also Emmeline Vance. Which, do you remember that name?
This one I do not.
She was a member of the Order of the Phoenix. She was part of the group of people with Remus, Tonks, and the others who collected Harry at the beginning of Book 5 and flew him to Grimmauld Place.
Okay.
She wasn't, like, really, you know, a prominent secondary character like the way Remus or Tonks or even Kingsley was, but she still was, you know, a member.
Okay. Okay. Well, good to know. I didn't know.
Yep. And then, is Sirius Black with a he who must not be named? Black? Sirius Black, you mean Merlin's beard? No. Black's dead. Turn out we were mistaken about Black. He was innocent after all, and he wasn't in league with he who must not be named either. I mean, he added defensively, spinning the bowler hat still faster. All the evidence appointments, we had more than 50 eyewitnesses, but anyway, as I said, he's dead. Murdered, as a fact, on Ministry of Magic premises. There's going to be an inquiry, actually.
Yeah, it sounds like Fudge is kind of grappling with that, like how that kind of shook out, too. You know, he was like, we had all these witnesses, but, you know, I don't know. So it sounds like he's kind of waffling on the...
Yeah, he is waffling, and... Again, I'm just curious what that inquiry of Ministry of Magic looks like, because Sirius died in the Department of Mysteries that no one is supposed to know about. It's like, how do you do an inquiry on Area 51?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Don't know. To his great surprise, the Prime Minister felt a fleeting stab of pity for Fudge at this point.
Yeah, that's... Oh.
Yeah. And so we're at war. Then... Good grief, so it's your fault those people were killed, not having to answer questions about rusted riggings and corroded expansion joints and I don't know what else. My fault? Are you saying you would have caved into blackmail like that? Maybe not to the Prime Minister, but I would have put all my efforts into catching a blackmailer before he committed any such atrocity.
Oh my.
Which, again, we don't, you know, the Prime Minister is... Again, we're supposed to be led to believe that Voldemort is like one of the most powerful, you know, wizards of the 20th century. That, you know, that just one wave of his wand and it'll be like nuclear war. But
gosh, that's stressful.
Anyway, but that triggered something of you know, not giving in to the demand and. You know, just made me think of Putin for a moment about, like, the balance of not wanting to give in his demands, but also not wanting to back him into a corner where he's desperate enough to push the button.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's a good point.
Yeah, but Voldemort is that type of villain where he's just going, destroy a bridge.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, like, dance being done at all, like, with Putin because, you know.
He's that was just me. Pure chaos. Yeah. What do they call it? Like, in... That I've talked about that before, like he's like
unlawful chaos, or
yeah, that's what he is, or something.
I remember all those, like, lawful, neutral, unlawful,
chaotic good,
chaotic good. Like,
yeah,
like,
sorry, I don't play D&D, but
neither do I. So it was the Death Eaters, and we suspect giant involvement, which shows that, again, from what we know of Hagrid, all the giants had been like. Run out to Eastern Europe. So that means they're now back in Britain.
Must be a reason that they're back.
Mm-hmm. Because they've joined with Voldemort. And it's interesting. I think we talked. In fact, I was just editing the episode of us discussing Hagrid's tale.
Oh, okay. Oh,
so it's all fresh in my mind, our discussion of, like, how much is the giant's violent tendencies, is that part of their innate culture, or is that something, you know, developed in response to their relationship with wizards and being forced together and everything. And likewise, like, I wonder what Voldemort promised them that is, like, Because if they are just more of a violent culture, then yeah, you get to tear shit up and, you know, just wreak havoc and I'll let you do that. And they're like, great, sweet.
Right.
Or is he promising them something a little more nuanced? Or I don't know. Because with the Dementors, it seems pretty clear, like, that I'll let you have as many victims, however many souls you want to suck out, just go crazy.
Yeah, and then, like, breed. Why not? I'm hung up on that.
Do you believe Dementors have right to reproductive health?
No! Sorry. No, not for Dementors. Like, Dementors, I'm sorry. The big Grim Reaper, because that's what it is in my mind. I don't know how that would work. Are they just people under there? Big, ugh. What can you get? Is that the fog? Is that what would that look like? I don't know. I think I thought way too deep into that when I shouldn't have, probably. The Dementor, like, you know, like I always say, I love romance. I'm a romantic. So there's my fan fiction Dementor romance novel.
Okay. Yeah. And then finally, it's like, now see here, Fudge, you got to do something. It's your responsibility as Minister of Magic. My dear Prime Minister, you can't honestly think I'm still Minister of Magic after all this. I was sacked 3 days ago.
No shit. I'm sorry. But this guy, thank God for that. That had to be coming.
I'm assuming that wasn't too much of a shock for you.
I mean, this guy is bad at his job. So mm-hmm. good riddance.
The whole wizarding community has been screaming for my resignation for a fortnight. I've never known them so united in my whole term of office.
What unites the... I'm trying to think. We have never been that angry toward a politician in the United States. Like, collectively angry toward one politician in my lifetime.
I think what? Well, there's a culture in Britain that when there's a collective anger, the prime ministers resign. Like Boris Johnson.
Like Boris Johnson. Yeah. That was...
Yeah, so... Wild. Yeah, so it's like, not that we should always give in to mob mentality, you know?
Yeah.
Mob mentality, but again, statistically, those belligerent ones supporting certain politicians, they're not the majority. They're just a belligerent minority.
Exactly. Much like the Roe decision. Also, not the good weekend for prime ministers. Pretty sad news about Shinzo Abe too. That was this past
week. Shinzo Abe, I know. Because again, not that I have any way followed Japanese politics, but I'm presuming that he was like just a normal politician who wasn't crazy like Trump or Boris. He seems to be quite beloved, that people are in his state of mourning. So it's like, why?
I had just been watching Elvis, and they were talking about the assassinations, you know, during that time period.
The only thing that's come out about Shinzo Abe is that the suspected shooter, it seems to be leaning in a direction of, like, solitary mental illness rather than some joint, you know, some sort of political motivation. Because the guy was saying that something about his mother being part of some, like, religious group that caused her financial difficulties, and I don't even remember how Shinzo Abe was like connected in this way.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so I'm sure more will come out, but yeah. R.I.P.
Also, yeah, poor guy, and being shot, that's not something that happens very often. I mean, that's here we have shootings every other minute, but
I think wasn't this the year that there's been a mass shooting at least once a week every week of 2022? I think so.
I believe it. That's terrible.
Yeah. Anyway, so Fudge has been sacked, rightly so. I wish we could pressure other politicians in this way in America.
Yeah.
But we can't. And then the new Minister of Magic comes forth. So he decides to come in through the flu. And so what was your impression of the new Minister of Magic?
We didn't really get a lot about this guy.
No, we didn't get a lot. With preliminary impressions.
If I'm just going to kind of, I mean, I hope a good vibe based on the fact that he's described as looking like an old lion, and my association there would be like Gryffindor. Mm-hmm. But so hopefully that's a positive indicator. But yeah, there wasn't much really to to go on, and it seemed fairly like, well, let's see what's coming with this guy. Mm-hmm. So.
And the impression of the Prime Minister is there was an immediate impression of shrewdness and toughness. The Prime Minister thought he understood why the wizarding community preferred Scrimshaw to Fudge as a leader in these dangerous times. In the mm-hmm. same way that Barty Crouch Sr. was favored, you know, in his time.
Yeah.
That tough on crime approach.
Yeah.
Yep. And then Fudge told you everything? Yes, yes. And then we have to think about his security. And it's like the new secretary in your outer office. I'm not getting rid of Kingsley Shacklebolt if that's what you're suggesting. He's highly efficient. That's because he's a wizard.
Glad to see Kingsley Shacklebolt's name pop up.
So he's a highly trained order who has been assigned to you for your protection. And again, like, it's, you know, all of what Scrimshaw and Fudge are, like, they're just dictating to him. Like, they're not having a conversation at all.
Yeah. No, it's kind of like, they're his little pawn or their little pawn or something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's Scrimshaw who talks about, it's Scrimshaw who tells the Prime Minister that, you know, your junior minister has started to, you know, try to strangle three healers.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. It shows up a little. Oh, yeah, there we go.
Yep. He'll be all right, won't he? Asked the Prime Minister anxiously. Scrimshaw merely shrugged, already moving back towards the fire. And it's like, well, that's it. Peace out.
And then it's done.
But it's like, but for heaven's sake, you're wizards. You can do magic. Surely you can sort out, well, anything. Scrimshaw turned slowly on the spot and exchanged an incredulous look with Fudge, who really did manage a smile this time as he said kindly, "The trouble is, the other side can do magic too, Prime Minister." And with that, the two wizards stepped off one after the other into the bright green flames and vanished.
I thought that was kind of a funny. I don't know how I felt about that at the end, because I was kind of like, this guy's got to realize if, like, they're warring factions of wizards. They're warring factions of wizards, but I guess, you know, magic can fix all. And
it shows a lack of understanding. Again, he's just thinking of magic in a very, I forget the terms, low magic versus high magic systems in fiction, whereas Harry Potter's system has been, I think, what is called a very high level magic, where it's treated kind of like science, where there are very distinct parameters, as opposed to just Gandalf waving his staff and doing whatever the hell he wants.
Okay.
So...
high magic, low magic, all of that. I know there's definitely, when I read it, I recognize it, but I don't, I don't know.
Yeah. And it's, again, it's an interesting thing why people, you know, like my husband say, they don't like, you know, fantasy, because they think, oh, you just wave the wand and everything is like better. And it's like, no, if fantasy is done well, then right. The parameters are different, but that still means people have to make, you know, very realistic, you know, have have realistic stressors and have to make certain decisions, even though the parameters of their universe are not quite the same as our own.
Right. Like, be consistent in the world. I think that's the key.
Yeah.
And there's got to be consequences for actions.
So. Is that Gibbous or Ghost?
This is Miss Ghost. She's missing her love, my husband. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Ooh, so cute. Alrighty then, and so that is the end of all the political stuff, and we get into some other adult stuff. Chapter 2, Spinner's End.
This was much more fun than the first chapter, I thought. But
yeah, so why was it more fun?
I mean, you know, seeing that side of Snape, I have a Mike Kedler. She'll back here in a minute. And kind of knowing that, you know, I'm done fussing with the microphone. Dumbledore has to trust Snape for some reason. Mm-hmm. And this almost seems like this chapter is trying to be a red herring. Like, or, you know, that Snape is definitely seems like he's on the dark side. So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It was just fun. And then Bellatrix and Sissy, which was kind of annoying.
Narcissa.
Just kind of seeing them in action. Lucius kind of takes up all the air in the room when he's around, so it was nice to have her moment, even though it was kind of desperate. But
yeah, because again, we've really The only time we've seen Narcissa up till this point was briefly in book 4 at the Quidditch World Cup. She didn't say anything.
Yeah. We just kind of know her by name only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and by family that she's, you know, by birth, she's a Black.
Oh, yeah.
Like Bellatrix. Like, they're both Black sisters and we're Sirius's cousins.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. I have a question. When we get to that part, I have a question about how they describe the two of them. But we'll get there.
Okay. So many miles away, there is, there's these two pups and there's a scrawny fox that slunk down the bank to nose, hopefully at some old fish and chip wrappings and the tall grass.
Aww.
Classic fish and chips. And then with a very faint pop, a slim hooded figure appeared out of thin air on the edge of the river. The fox froze. Then with a second loud pop, another hooded figure materialized. Wait. And then Bellatrix just kills the fox.
Horrible person. Horrible witch. Bellatrix, no thank you.
Yeah.
Don't kill a fox. So cute.
And then the second figure turned over the animal with its toe. Just the fox, said a woman's voice dismissively from under the hood. I thought perhaps an horror. Sissy, wait. And so we've got a situation. We've got Narcissa and Bellatrix, you know, seemed arguing. It's like, that, you know, obviously you didn't know where they were going. So what were you thinking as, you know, they're having this argument going through like the alleyways and stuff?
I mean, it just kind of seemed like they were just chasing each other, Bellatrix was just chasing Narcissa. And yeah, you didn't really know where they were going to land. I thought it was just kind of like as she was trying to run away from her. And I don't know if she was like going to shake her or not, but I didn't know there was an intention, you know, an intended place until mm-hmm. we ended up on Snape's front door.
So. Yep. And then, Sissy, you must not do this. You can't trust him. The Dark Lord trusts him, doesn't he? The Dark Lord is, I believe, mistaken. And Narcissa gets to a point, gets frustrated enough, where she points her wand at Bellatrix. And Bellatrix is like, Sissy, your own sister, you wouldn't. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, they have another sister that they've disowned, which is Tonks' mother. So it's like, your own sister, it's like, you have another sister that you guys have disowned and wouldn't care if died.
Yeah. I don't really know if this is the group of people that loyalty means a lot to, other than to Voldemort. But.
Yeah. And it's like, Sissy, your own sister, you wouldn't. There is nothing I wouldn't do anymore, Narcissa breathes. Which, that kind of made me think of a line that Lena Headey gives as Cersei Lannister, where, you know, Jaime is, like, criticizing her for, like, you know, helping in, you know, the sentencing of Tyrion. And he's like, there's really nothing you wouldn't do. And she's like, for my family? No, there are things I would do for my family you wouldn't even imagine.
Did you see that you made me think of this because it was a very confusing thing. This woman, politician, who said she would shoot her own grandkids to protect her grandkids. Did you see that?
Protect her from what?
I will send you the clip later. But when you're talking about family, she was talking about, you know, the Second Amendment. And she said, I would shoot my own grandkids to protect my grandkids. Now, what I think she meant is that she would shoot a grandkid if it was like if the grandkid was threatening the other grandchildren. But it is the most confusing thing you'll ever listen to. But anyway, it was making the rounds on the internet and it was very confusing.
So they're running around and, you know, as we heard from Bellatrix's scathing comments, this is definitely a muggle neighborhood. And it's very much described as a very working class, super old type of town.
Which isn't too surprising when Snape's gonna be there.
Yep. And then so we got together. They stood waiting, panting slightly, breathing in the smell of the dirty river that was carried to them on the night breeze. After a few seconds, they heard movement behind the door and it opened a crack. A sliver of a man could be seen looking out at them. The man with long black hair parted in curtains around a sallow face and black eyes. So did you immediately know it was Snape?
Oh yeah. I mean, I feel like if we're gonna talk about long dark hair, it's hard to yeah. And the way they described him, I'm like, okay, this is Snape.
Yeah. And so they come in and they had stepped directly into a tiny sitting room which had the feeling of a dark padded cell. The walls were completely covered in books, most of them bound in old bracken brown leather. A threadbare sofa, an old armchair, and a rickety table stood grouped together. Like, this is my ultimate, like, dark academia, well, what's the female version of man cave? Like,
Chick Cove. That's what I have a friend that calls it that, Chick Cove or whatever.
So. Yeah. But yeah, I would definitely want this as my sort of like dark academia, witchy ambiance with a cauldron and everything.
Yeah, this definitely didn't like not appeal to me. I was reading it and I was thinking like, this is kind of supposed to be kind of like, ugh, he's so spooky. And I was like, oh, that's pretty sweet. So.
Yep. And who else is there? Seems little Wormtail, the little bitch.
This surprised me. I thought he was donezo. I thought he was gone. And then here he is. So I haven't puzzled this out yet, but I was surprised that
he was there. He wasn't at the Ministry of Magic. So there, we haven't really seen any element of Wormtail since the crazy spooky ritual with the cauldron where he cut off his hand and got his magical silver hand.
Yeah. Okay, good. So I haven't just totally forgot.
It's not like he died and you forgot about it. No.
Okay. Okay. I was like, I'm thinking of like a Dolores situation where it's kind of like in the wind, but.
Yeah, no, it's, Wormtail, even though he switched sides, like Wormtail was friends with all the guys Snape hated. So it's kind of an odd combo. And then obviously not there by, you know, their own designs. It's Voldemort has kind of said, you stay with Snape and do what he tells you.
Yeah. This is weird. This is a weird dynamic.
And it's like, Wormtail will get us drinks if you'd like them, and then he will return to his bedroom. And Wormtail first balks at, like, being a servant. It's like, oh, you want more dangerous work? That can be arranged.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, Snape really is, like, sticks it to him there.
Which, again, like, Wormtail, or any of the Death Eaters, it's like, there's no real love in any of these dynamics, and it's all like fighting for who's the most loyal, and it's like, this guy's not a good boss. Like, why?
No, he does not create a culture like of teamwork or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just the motivations of Wormtail have of being, you know, thinking that, oh, like double crossing my friends is gonna work out for me in the long run, and it didn't.
Right.
Yeah. And so eventually Wormtail brings all the glasses and wine, he leaves, and let's see, I think you're the only one who can help me, says Narcissa. Snape held up a hand to stop her and then pointed his wand again at the concealed staircase door. There was a loud bang and a squeal, followed by the sound of Wormtail scurrying back up the stairs.
Because he's been, like, listening, like, can you blame him? I would too.
Yeah, which, anyway, so Narcissa's there saying, I ought not to be here. I've been told to say nothing, you know. Then you ought to hold your tongue, snarled Bellatrix, particularly in present company. So I don't really want to go dissect this word by word. But, you know, before we get to what Narcissa wants, you know, Snape goes through all of this stuff, justifying to Bellatrix some of his behavior and why that proves he's loyal and, like, all this stuff. What were your thoughts?
I mean, he's doing the thing that I don't quite love I'm not a dishonest person. I tend to probably fall maybe too honest. I don't like manipulation either. Like, just, I hate that. I'm not good at that kind of, like, game. It annoys me. So this kind of felt like, again, because I'm kind of framing it as, like, Snape never really commits to anything. You know, when he says something about the secret, it's like, well, then he shouldn't say anything. And it's like, well, because he already knows it. It's like, he's doing the thing where he's like, he's being manipulative and secretive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think he's a double, like, he's a double agent, basically.
Or triple or quadruple.
Yeah, he's a mini faceted agent. But, and Bellatrix's inclination isn't really wrong, but the kind of allegiance that he has towards Voldemort is interesting because, like, we all know Voldemort doesn't, like, tolerate foolishness, you know, mm-hmm. suffer fools or whatever. So it's interesting. I, as I barfing on saying this, he must be a pretty clever guy to have, you know, both sides, but who his loyalty is to more. I mean, I think it's Dumbledore, but just based on, again, me knowing things from the fan reaction, I feel like he was totally evil. People wouldn't like him as much. He's not a Dolores Umbridge, even though if I were reading this, like, without kind of the knowledge, I would think, oh, here's my evidence that Snape really is evil. So,
Yeah. So he's, because he just plays off of, you know, I didn't know the Dark Lord was back. I had no motive to kill Harry Potter right under Dumbledore's nose. And I had no motive to want Quirrell to have the Sorcerer's Stone because I didn't know he was working with Voldemort. So, like, so he very much portrays, you know, the characteristics of a self-serving Slytherin. It's like, you know, I just don't do these things. So, if anything, Bellatrix is exhibiting a lot of Gryffindor-like loyalty qualities.
Yes.
Like in believing in these huge, grand gestures of allegiance and loyalty, which is very, very one-dimensional in a lot of ways. And that's exactly what a lot of Slytherins criticize Gryffindors for lacking that nuance. So, that if anything... makes sense. So anything, Bellatrix is being very, like, hard-headed, and Snape is just like, you know, I'm not gonna just, you know, go around doing crazy things for the quote-unquote ideological purpose. It has to serve something, which killing or doing anything adversarial to Dumbledore without knowing Voldemort was back would not have been productive to anyone.
Yeah, he definitely presents it in a more strategic way, and I kind of do get the impression that Snape is more strategic, and I'm not going to say that because I know I'm going to eat my words. So never mind. So I'm stopping myself before I say it. But he's definitely thinking about things a little more in a complex way, in a manipulative way. He's manipulative.
Yep. And so that kind of shuts Bellatrix up, at least for a little bit. And then we move on to Narcissa, who seems to be very, very distraught. And it's like, you should, if the Dark Lord says, you know, not to say anything, you shouldn't say anything. Luckily for you, I already know the plan.
Does he? I don't know.
Yeah. What is this plan? It's clearly something that Draco has been asked to do.
Right.
Something has been asked to do. Narcissa is suspicious that, you know, Draco was not given this task as a high honor, but rather that Draco was given this task as punishment for Lucius, who is currently now in Azkaban because he was apprehended at the Ministry.
And Snape doesn't really disagree with that. It seems like, hello, it seems very much like that's the case.
Okay, one moment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What is it?
Clocky. Okay, I'll find it.
Please give me one moment because I just heard a cat knock something over.
Okay.
Hold on a second. I'm sorry.
These kittens. Mia. Oh.
Here's Henri Ghost.
Oh, cute ghost who misses her daddy so much.
Yes, she does. She's wrecking the house because of it. So.
Oh, dear. When is he going to be back?
I never know. So usually by the time we wrap up, if sometimes we're going a little longer, but hopefully this is just their wilding hour and then they'll fall asleep, but they're being ornery right now.
Anyway, to return. So Narcissa has these suspicions and she is like literally sobbing on the floor because she's thinking that whatever it seems that Draco has been asked to do, Narcissa seems to believe that there's a strong likelihood that he could die in the attempt of doing it.
Yeah, and it's very much...
What do you think this plan, this thing is?
I have no idea. I do think it is not to bestow an honor upon Draco. I think it is because Lucius screwed up in Voldemort's mind. So this is a way to... you know, really send the point home that he should have done the job right, which, like, we know what happens, that it was a little hard to have happen. I don't know, because I was thinking, like, kill Harry, but, like, how would he do that? And, you know, I don't really think he's going to have him kill Harry, but something put Harry in a situation that he would be very at risk. Maybe lure him out to the dark forest and, you know, I don't know.
Okay, so, alrighty then. So yeah, put a pin in that. So, and we know from Snape that it's like, the Dark Lord's not going to change his mind about Draco doing it. He will not be persuaded, and I am not stupid enough to attempt it. So the only thing is, and again, Narcissa's crying, and she's like, my only son. You should be proud, Bella said Bellatrix ruthlessly. If I had sons, I would be glad to give them up to the service of the Dark Lord.
And she probably would, because she's a mess. So
yeah. Like, it's funny. It's like, up until this point, like, we've been introduced to Bellatrix as a character, but in all these dynamics, like, we've never seen her interacting or even talking to or about her husband, who is also broken out. Like, she's just all about the Dark Lord.
She's, you know, I guess that's a cool thing. I don't know.
Yeah. And so Snape says, like, I can't persuade the Dark Lord. It might be possible for me to help Draco. And so she's like, Severus, would you help him? Would you look after him? See, he comes to no harm. I can try. And she's like, if you are there to protect him, Severus, will you swear it? Will you make the unbreakable vow?
Okay, this is something that's new, right? I haven't heard of this yet.
Yes, this has not ever been mentioned yet.
Okay, good. Because for a second I was like, am I supposed to know what this is? Okay, this was the big reveal, a big crescendo on this chapter, basically.
Yeah. And Bellatrix is like, oh, he'll try. The usual empty words, the usual slithering out of action. Oh, the Dark Lord's orders, of course. And he's like, certainly, Narcissa, I shall make the unbreakable vow. And Bellatrix is like, what?
Because this is like that, at least as I understood it, this is him. She's always thought, oh, he's just kind of messing with this. Is like, he's not really committed. And this is basically him being very committed.
Yeah, this is being very committed, even though you do not know, you know, exactly all that entails. But just by the name Unbreakable Vow and the level of ceremony, like,
yes,
some sort of hand fasting shit that's going on.
It's pretty serious. Like, I feel like this may result in his death, but by, you know, agreeing to this.
Yeah, so we've got, so will you, Severus, watch over my son Draco as he attempts to fulfill the Dark Lord's wishes? I will. And will you, to the best of your ability, protect him from harm? I will. And should it prove necessary, if it seems Draco will fail, will you carry out the deed that the Dark Lord has ordered Draco to perform? And he's like, I will.
Ooh, all right.
So is it going to be Snape luring Harry out to the Dark Forest, or?
You know, somebody's luring somebody out to the Dark Forest. That's my, no, I don't know. This is very, I don't know what this is all about. So mm-hmm. I'll find out, hopefully. Yep. Probably at the very end of the damn book. So that's fine. It's fine. I'll wait.
Alrighty then. And those are our two chapters. Again, very telling. Setting a tone, even though you don't know exactly what it means, very telling that, again, that Harry, as the writer, feels the need to give this context that isn't just his POV, that he went out of his way to do his extra research, whether looking at people's memories or getting Rita Skeeter or, like, something to get, you know, this information.
Yeah, he's not starting. And it definitely starts with a very serious tone, not... You know, I would say the Riddle House was dark, which I like to say, but this is more, there's a with the Dursleys, there's just kind of a, what would I call it? And not comedic, that's not the right word, but just kind of a silliness with the Dursleys because they're so mm-hmm. ridiculous. And there was nothing really ridiculous. This definitely read very, you know, this is a business time.
Yeah, so, and also with the Riddle House, though it was dark, it showed very quickly that it was many, many years in the past, so there was sort of a distance of a story being told, like something that happened maybe like in the 50s or whatever, whereas this is very much all the dark shit that's happening right now.
Right, yeah, this is current happenings.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty then, so, Our first exercise, of course, is Gothic Geek Out.
Well, I think you kind of already exposed the it would be Snape's house, Snape's place, whatever it is. That's pretty gothic, like you said, that your dark academic, you know, setting, cave or, you know, she shed, whatever. He always brings kind of the emo incel vibe, I think is what you always say. But
gothic emo incel?
Yes. So we'll just put this more in the gothic. It's even his books are kind of like...
They're all black and brown leather.
Yeah, which I was like, what the hell is that all about? Now I'm looking at my books and they're definitely not all black and brown. But, Snape's Place. That was my gothic. Yeah,
and I'm sure he doesn't have, as reader listeners cannot see right now, but in my camera, sitting on my shelf is my little plushie of my cat with a little burgundy shawl and hoods, and she's called Little Red Riding Kitty.
Yeah, he probably doesn't have one of those. I was like, what do I have on my shelf? I don't know. A ton of stuff because I'm a mess right now. So
yeah, I'm a mess too as well. I need to reorganize everything. But anyway, so yeah, definitely. So you didn't think of anything beyond that?
The only thing I don't know.
The only thing I thought of, yeah, that's definitely, you know, Snape's house, obviously very much. And clearly this is only the house he goes to in the summer, because at school time, he's always like, you know, the professors live, you know, at the castle.
You just made me laugh, like Snape's summer home. And it's like this gothic, you know, usually think of like sun and beaches, and this is like dark.
A lake house.
Yeah, right.
Well, there is a river. So yes, and so... You know, the living room is covered in books, but also by extension, the gothicness of, you know, Spinner's End. Just Spinner's End, that very much invokes a spider to me.
Yeah, unfortunately for me too. Yeah.
Spinners. So just the whole name of it, and as I described, kind of comes off as this very poor working class industrial town. And if anything, it kind of reflects more a type of gothic, not the countryside castle, but the sort of more urban Victorian, like Dickens-like, you know,
yeah,
grittiness of like working class England.
Yeah, it kind of is like a modern day vampire vibe too. It makes me think of Only Lovers Left Alive, which is in kind of like the in Detroit. I don't know.
Yeah. Alrighty then. So yeah. Snape's, all of Snape's books and his living area. That's what's gothic.
What if he this is also what I imagined, because I was like, the uniformity in that is like kind of would drive me crazy. But what if they were all like romance novels and he just was like, just trying to look like a badass, but secretly he's like, I just really love a good rom-com. We don't know. Probably not.
That you made me think of something. Okay. You know, Lacey, who was, you know, on our show for Snape's Worst Memory. So we were, you know, she's my coworker. So we were both at this conference at the University of Mississippi, and we were on our coffee break, and I was reading in the coffee break, you know, I was at my table at the conference, and I was sitting there reading one of my fairy romance, you know, a deal with an elf king, you know, which you've seen the cover. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
like I like it.
Of the, you know, the girl with the elf king in the back. Kind of embracing her. And so I'm reading this because, quite frankly, I know a lot of those people because I've been to this annual meeting, this conference multiple times. Like, I had no shame whatsoever. I didn't consider the cover to be that salacious.
Right.
But Lacey came up and she's like, Amy, like, I would never have the courage to read that in front of like all my work colleagues. Like, if I were to read like a romance book, I would have like over it, like Why Taiwan Matters, something like nonfiction, super academic to make myself look smart.
I mean, a lot of very smart people read romance and elf romance, and shoot, the ACOTAR series is insanely popular. So elves and all that.
Yeah. Very. So, yeah, that just made me think. So maybe Snape is like Lacey, who cannot rock the fairy or vampire romance on its own and has to disguise it as something more academic.
I'm convinced. There's got to be at least one. There's one on there.
Alrighty then, and now we move on to Tarot of the Day, which the card I pulled at random, the card that I pulled from my new crow tarot because the cats peed on the one you got me for my birthday, which still sucks.
They blessed it, and I'm excited to see the art that you're going to create with.
Yeah, like for I threw all the ones that were tainted, and all the I may make some sort of collage or whatever with.
I'm kind of curious about the ones they peed on. Hopefully, there wasn't like a big one. I don't know. It's
fun. But anyway, so I have my new cards that have like the Crow Tarot, which has all ravens, which is a really cool design. But anyway, card I picked was the Two of Swords.
All right.
Yeah, the Two of Swords. That's description. Where's the meaning? Ah, here we are. Two of Swords indicates that you are facing a challenging decision, but you are unclear about which option to take. Both possibilities may seem equally good or equally bad, and you are stumped about which will lead you to the best outcome. You must be able to weigh up the pros and cons of each choice and then make a conscious judgment. Use both your head, your mind, and intellect, and your heart, your feelings, and intuition to choose the path that is most in alignment with your higher self. Well, this makes me think of, you know, Snape's predicament and being put faced with the prospect of an unbreakable vow.
Yes, for sure. That whole scene. I was thinking too of Bellatrix and her just kind of, we know she's like crazy, but her suspicion of Snape. I don't know why that's what came to mind, but.
Yeah, because we don't really get a lot of, because this is Snape's whole thing. Like, you don't know what he's thinking because he has a very good occlumens. He can protect his mind and all those things. So we don't really get any indication of how Snape is processing, you know, when the words the unbreakable vow are thrown out. So right. We don't really get to see that. But clearly something had to be going on in his brain because obviously that's not probably a very, you know, not a very light bit of magic. You
know, no.
That is something that is binding in some capacity.
I'm excited to find out, but yeah, the unbreakable vow, like if, you know, that's not, these words have weight, especially in the wizarding world, so.
Yeah. So the woman in this card wears a blindfold indicating that she cannot see the entirety of her circumstances. You may lack the information you need to make the right decision. You may be missing something such as threats or potential risk, alternative solutions, or critical pieces of information that would help guide you in a particular direction. Once you remove the blindfold and see the situation for what it really is, you would be in a much better position to find your best path forward. Which, this makes me think of Narcissa.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, this makes me think of Narcissa because she is very much acting out of desperation. And, you know, she says that, you know, Draco's always liked you, like you've always been Lucius's good friend. Like, so there is some level of camaraderie, but at the same time, as we know, we're in this context where all these, like, Death Eaters are competing with each other. So even though there's a little bit of good rapport, like, at the end of the day, that's probably not going to mean much in comparison to, like, what Voldemort directly orders and forbids and all of those things. So she's, you know, she's in a position where she is also blindfolded, you know, metaphorically because, you know, she has very limited options and very few people she can talk to about this to get any sort of substantial help.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, not, you know, Snape is being bound in this way, but I don't know, what about the recipient of the unbreakable vow, like Narcissa, does this in any way but come to bite, will this come in any way to bite her in the ass?
I don't know. And like, I kind of wondered, like, with Lucius too, because to me it almost seems like the ceremony kind of seemed like a marriage ceremony, like it was binding these two people, and I'm like, well, what the hell is Lucius gonna be like? So now you're marrying my wife, like what the hell? So I don't know. I'm so curious about the complexity of this.
And then we've got Two of Swords comes as a reminder that many of life's decisions are difficult ones and rarely come with clear-cut answers. The invitation is to make your choices with your best intentions, fully aware of the possible consequences. Avoidance will lead to greater conflict and stagnation.
Did Snape do that? I don't know.
yeah, did Snape do that? Or did Narcissa do that? Like, did she make a very rash decision out of desperation? Will this end up saving Draco's life? We don't know yet.
She definitely made a very emotional decision in the moment.
Indeed. And so now we can move on to, you know, my Black Moon astrology cards, the Oracle card of the day, which the one I picked was actually one of the 12 houses.
Oh, okay.
And this one I picked the 12th house.
12th house.
Which, here, what we got? It's on page 130 of my little booklet. 12th house, escape. It is time to get on point. It's not a time to ignore or overlook what's there. Things may get fragmented. The 12th house of the zodiac is the most mesmerizing of all the houses. Mysticism, dreaming, drowning, vast seas, and surrendering. All are themes that belong to the house of self-undoing. It is also the place in the chart where we lapse in our judgment and make bad choices.
Oh, Snape might have made a bad choice here, huh?
Yep, Snape might have made a bad choice. Narcissa may have made a bad choice. Bellatrix may have made a bad choice.
We will find out, hopefully.
Yeah, so, yeah, the house of self-undoing. So I tend to veer this more towards, like, yeah, Snape probably signed up for something that, again, he can't get out of, but,
yeah,
you know, this might be the undoing of Narcissa in some, maybe in some other way. Even though astrologers refer to the 12th house as the gutter or garbage dump of the zodiac, it is still distinct. It is still distinct in its meaning. Evolved souls and the doomed live here. Within the 12th house are the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows, ruled by Neptune, the planet of confusion and drunkenness. Prisoners, shut-ins, saints, artists, and mystics call this home. Okay.
I was like, what planet? Now I'm wondering what planets I have in the 12th house. It's probably like all of them. I don't know.
Yeah, that's so crazy. Yeah, prisoners, Bellatrix.
Yeah.
Mystics, artists, saying, yeah. Imagination, linking up, and connecting to the unknown are all facets of the 12th house. It is where the material and non-physical worlds connect. It is both the beginning and the end.
Wow.
Yeah, the 12th house offers bliss, spiritual fulfillment, and the meeting up with twin flames. Interesting to say twin flames in light of that sort of hand-fastening thing they did with the unbreakable vow.
Yes.
It promises of losing yourself in some beautiful other, but it might be like trying to hold on to a cloud. This house of poetry and oceans is enchantment. It is what we lie to ourselves as well.
Wow.
So this is full of paradoxes, it seems.
Yeah.
The 12th house. I don't know if I have any planets in my 12th house. I need to like go back and like redo my and print out my natal chart and figure this shit out.
Yeah, me too.
Because I do know exactly when I was born. I was born at 7:53 p.m. Pacific time.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. I was born at 53 as well.
Oh, nice.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so when the 12th house card comes up in a reading, something is amiss. There's something about the situation you are unsure about or at least not privy to. Well, I think that says a lot about.
Yeah, that's our...
Bellatrix is not privy to certain things. Narcissa is not privy to things. Probably Snape is bullshitting and isn't privy to certain things.
Right. Exactly.
Alrighty then. So, yeah. I did not know that this house would work so well.
I didn't know this was so bleak. This house was so bleak. Mm-hmm. But.
Yeah. Alrighty then, yeah. Good stuff. And then we move on to our final exercise, which is fan fiction time.
Well, I felt like that I didn't really want to mess with the second chapter we read. So what if there was not the connection in the muggle and wizarding world? Like, what if they were just kind of on their own and wizards thought so, you know, they thought not so highly. I can't talk. That they were like, we're not even going to talk to them about our business.
Yeah. I think certainly that would involve like a certain, you know, a blatant disregard for human life, because this also ties into something I've thought about, that, you know, when Voldemort gets to a point where it's now like open warfare, you know, even though he's wreaking havoc and the Prime Minister is dealing with it, it's still in a way that, you know, that the Ministry can still cover up as, you know, accidents.
Yeah.
It's not like full, you know, because for a long time I would question like, okay, if he's out in the open now, like, why does he care? He thinks he should, that wizard should be supreme. Why isn't he out in the open just killing people with his wand and like revealing magic? And so I thought about, I'm like, why isn't he doing that? Like, why is he holding back? But then I come in, you know, when I get older and understand the intricacies of international politics, is the decision to stay hidden from the Muggles is not just a British decision. That's a decision that all wizards across the globe have decided to make.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so that if Voldemort were to, like, you know, go all out to the point that the Ministry couldn't like conceal everything anymore, then that politically would, you know, just bring everyone, all the wizards of the world down on Voldemort, and probably would not be able to handle that.
That's a good point.
So yeah, like, if he was not mentioning, and the way they just dictate things, like, they're not even offering the Prime Minister like advice of here's what you can do in this situation, you know, protect, say that it's this, so that, say something else is going on so that people are more careful. Like, they're not even giving him like a game plan of like what to say,
right? No,
what to say to people. So if anything, like, telling him isn't, beyond giving him specific personal protection, they're not really doing anything in terms of policy,
right?
You know, to help the situation for Muggles be better in this chaos,
right? Yeah, no, they're really not. I mean, it is definitely one-sided. And then I guess too, not that it would be kind of like a naive thing, but, you know, the Muggle minister is not saying like, is there anything we can do to help, you know, help you or anything? I mean, granted, I know he is the only one who can know, but I'm sure he could do something. And he's just kind of sitting there like,
or like it said, here are all these orrs. Tell them what, you know, seems like we're giving you all these wizards at your disposal, Prime Minister. Tell them what they need to do magically to like cover everything, or like, you know, but even they do that all on their end by themselves. So, yeah. So if anything, I don't think it helps a great deal, because, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's my best fan fiction this week. I didn't want to mess with chapter 2.
Oh, I did.
And you did. Yes.
I wanted to think, what would the dynamics be if Snape had refused the Unbreakable Vow? Because it's hard to say, at least right now, when you don't know exactly what the plan for Draco is and what the Unbreakable Vow entails. But what would it mean if Snape were to refuse, to just be like, I don't have to prove shit to you?
I feel like Bellatrix would have lost her mind. Like, the better play was to have him, to have Snape be like, to shock Bellatrix with his level of commitment, rather than be like, oh no, I'm not doing that. Cause I feel like she's just looking for a reason to get rid of him or something.
But she's already so suspicious that, and it seems that, you know, Voldemort's kind of already aware of Bellatrix's opinion in regards to Snape. So would that really matter? Does Bellatrix's suspicion really mean anything? Because I'm thinking more like, you know, you can, you know, given in terms of Snape's history of self-preservation, I think it would have been believable for him to say, yeah, I'll try, but at the end of the day, this is Draco's job, and if I step in, I'm going to be in some serious shit.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That was kind of a lose-lose situation for Snape, I'm guessing. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I the only thing I think, you know, Bellatrix could have gone to Voldemort and been like, so, guess what? You know, and told him, which we know, kind of like you said, what Voldemort thinks of her. I don't know. This whole Bellatrix, is there any sort of, I shouldn't ask that because you probably can't tell me, but I get like Bellatrix is like in love with Voldemort in some capacity, which is, but I know, I mean,
probably. About,
yeah. I don't know, man. That's, it's so, this dang unbreakable vow has really got me curious. So.
Yeah, and yeah, I think, again, Bellatrix brings up, you know, some good points, but ultimately, you know, part of me, you know, thinks that Bellatrix is, you know, motivation is more of, you know, she's willing to cling to anything because, again, all this is about a competition for, like, loyalty and stuff. And yeah, certainly, you know, probably in the beginning when she first got out of Azkaban, she was like, you know, Queen shit a fuck mountain when Voldemort was rewarding her. It's like, oh, you were in, you know, you were loyal to me like to the end and spent years in Azkaban for me. But that's kind of gone away now and she screwed up at the ministry. So now like her probably status and is waning. And if anything, yeah, you know, people like Snape who were smarter and more strategic rather than just blatantly these blatant displays of allegiance has ended up being more useful to Voldemort, especially now.
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't know. I just have a feeling, I tend to be of the opinion that if Snape were to be like, no, I'm not doing that. And Bellatrix just be like, aha, aha, you won't do it, blah, blah, blah. And just been like, okay, you already didn't trust me anyway. And
yeah,
already knows that like your suspicion is not a threat to me.
Yeah, he's, I mean, you know, we talked about him being kind of a master manipulator. So I'm sure he would be like, well, but I mean, you know, he would have kind of mind freaked Bellatrix. Because I don't know if Bellatrix is, I don't know enough about her yet. She's kind of insane, but that's all I know. Yeah. So.
Alrighty then. And that concludes our first ever episode about Half-Blood Prince. Will you tune in next time where we will be going over chapters 3 and 4, Will and Won't, and Horace Slughorn.
What the world?
Yeah. New character.
He looks like a little slughorn. That's funny. All right.
Yeah. All right, then. Catch you guys later. Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.